Sitting of Parliament, Friday, 21st of February, 2014. Bill. First and second reading. A bill for an act to amend the Stamp Duty Act 2005. The Honourable Richardson. Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Stamp Duty Act 2005. Be read a first time. I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Stamp Duty Act 2005 be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Stamp Duty Amendment Act 2013. Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill be now read a second time. This bill, Mr. Speaker, amends the Stamp Duty Act 2005 for two principal purposes. First of all, introducing an exemption from stamp duty on any instrument whereby property is transferred between spouses or between the dissolution or following the dissolution of marriage between former spouses. Secondly, introducing a zero rate of stamp duty where either the value of the property does not exceed £250,000, the purchaser, or is more than one, each of the purchases is a first time or second time buyer, and the property being bought is residential property. LPS have looked at the bill, Mr. Speaker, which implements budget measures and have concerns to the government that it enables them to give business efficacy to those measures. Under new section 19A, the definition of a first-time buyer is given as a person being an individual who has not previously been a purchaser of property subject to duty, where the real property in Gibraltar consisted of residential property. The definition of person, Mr. Speaker, as an individual is designed to ensure that this zero rate can only apply when it is an individual real person who is a purchaser and not a company. The definition refers to residential property, so that if the individual has a business and so has previously bought property for commercial purposes, he is still a first-time buyer for the purposes of the Act if he then goes on to buy residential property for the first time. Furthermore, the definition of first-time buyer and second-time buyer refers to a purchaser of property subject to duty because the definition in the Stamp Duty Act 2005 of property subject to duty relates to buying real property or to any interest in a company that owns your property. This means that if you previously bought property through a company for residential purposes more than once, then you are no longer a first or second time buyer. Admittedly, though, according to the Government Land Property Agency, LPS, and most properties that are owned by companies are over the £250,000 threshold, and checking if the existence of a previous property interest held by a company may be difficult or impossible if shares have been held by a trust. For this purpose, and at the suggestion, the useful suggestion of LPS, we have included a certificate requirement in the new section, in the new section 19A, so that the purchaser has to sign a certificate confirming that they are a first or second time buyer for the purposes of the Act. A person who issues a false or misleading statement or is reckless as to whether the statement is false or misleading commits an offence. The level of fine is the same as that in section 6 for setting out incorrect facts or information in the instrument affecting how much duty is chargeable. This goes some way, we advise, Mr. Speaker, in dealing with those issues. Mr. Speaker, generally, the amendments made to this bill are deemed to have come into operation on Budget Day, the 24th of June last year, as this bill gives effect to the provisions set out in my speech on the Appropriation Bill. I commend the bill to the House. Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Stamp Duty Act 2005 be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Stamp Duty Amendment Act 2013.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to give notice that the committee stays on third reading of the bill being taken today with all honourable members here. Do all honourable members agree that the committee stage and fourth reading of the bill be taken today?
A bill for an act to prohibit bullying and victimisation in employment and for connected purposes. The Honourable Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to prohibit bullying and victimisation in employment and for connected purposes be read a first time.
I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to prohibit bullying and victimisation in employment and for collective purposes be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Employment Bullying at Work Act 2013.
The Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill be now read a second time. Mr. Speaker, this bill implements one of our key manifesto commitments. The purpose of the bill is to prohibit bullying and victimisation in employment. Members of the House will be aware that a command paper was presented and published in January 2012 on this matter, and that the command paper contained a draft bill titled Rights to Dignity at Work Act 2012. Responses to the command paper were received and considered, and a working group, which comprised of members of Dawn, the Dignity at Work Union, Unite, and the DGCA were set up in January 2013 to further develop the draft bill. The bill before this House is therefore different to the bill that appeared in the command paper following consultations with the working group. Mr. Speaker, the bill itself is intended to provide a legislative structure to tackle bullying in a way that goes further than the current provisions and harassment in the Equal Opportunities Act 2006. The Employment Act and the Crimes Act 2011. The Act, by virtue of Clause 3.2, is binding on the Crown. Clause 4 defines what amounts to bullying under the Act. It provides that bullying takes place where a person engages in conduct which has the purpose or effect of causing another person to be alarmed, distressed, humiliated, or intimidated. This conduct includes persistent behaviour which is offensive, intimidating, abusive, malicious, or insulting, persistent, unjustified criticism, punishment imposed without justification, and changes in the duties or responsibilities of a person to that person's detriment without reasonable justification. Bullying does not include reasonable action taken by an employer relating to the management and direction of the employee or the employee's employment as set out in Clause 4.3 of the Act. Clause 5 defines what conduct amounts to victimization under the Act. It provides that victimization takes place where one person treats another less favorably because he or she, in good faith, has, for example, taken or supported any action taken for the purpose of the Act, including in relation to any alleged breach of its provision. It also provides that victimization takes place where one person treats another less favorably because he or she is suspected of having done this or of intending to do this. A person is not protected from victimization where he or she maliciously makes or supports an untrue complaint. The section replicates the effects of the provision in the Equal Opportunities Act 2006 as regards victimization, and that's section 13 of the Equal Opportunities Act that I'm referring to. Clause 6, Mr. Speaker, makes it unlawful for an employer to subject employees and people applying for employment to bullying. It also makes the employer liable for bullying of its employees by third parties, such as customers or clients, over whom the employer does not have direct control. Liability in relation to said passive bullying will, however, only arise when bullying has occurred on at least two previous occasions. The employer is aware that it has taken place and has not taken reasonable steps to prevent it happening again. However, Clause 6.5 provides that an employer will not be in controversy in Clause 6.1 in relation to a complaint of bullying where he or she can show that at the time of the act or act complained of, he or she had enforced a bullying at work policy in accordance with the schedule, and that he or she has taken all reasonable steps to implement and enforce the said policy. Whether he or she will not be in contravention, if as soon as it is reasonably practicable, the employer takes all steps that are reasonably necessary to remedy any loss, damage, or other detriment suffered by the complainant as a result of the act or acts complained of. The schedule provides for the bullying at work policy. It sets out that the policy must be in writing, must be distributed to every employee, and must include the following. An explanation of the statutory right of employees not to be subjected to bullying and victimization, and a statement that bullying and victimization will not be tolerated. Examples of bullying behavior, and of the conduct that may lead to disciplinary action. a statement of the procedure for bringing complaints in the manner in which they will be dealt with, a designation of a competent person to whom complaints will be made, a statement of what is the clear procedure to be followed against employees who infringe the policy, details of designated persons available to counsel, assist and advise individuals who bring complaints or who are subject of complaints, arrangements to train all those occupying any position of managerial authority and to inform all employees of the policy, annual monitoring of the operation of the policy, and arrangements for consultation with trade unions, safety representatives and or other stakeholders on the operation of the policy, its implementation, and any revision. Clause 7 makes it unlawful for an employer to victimize employees. It applies in respect of anything done in the course of a person's employment. And Clause 8 provides that the Industrial Tribunal has jurisdiction to hear the claims under the Act. This clause replicates the effects of provisions in the Equal Opportunities Act and the Employment Act. The clause also deals with time limits. A person must bring a claim within 3 months of the alleged conduct taking place. If a person wants to make a claim after that period, it is at the Industrial Tribunal's discretion whether they grant permission to allow them to do so. The test applied by the Industrial Tribunal is what is just and equitable in the circumstances. Where conduct in respect of which a claim under the Act might arise continues over a period of time, the time stops to run at the end of that period. Clause 9 sets out the remedies available to the Industrial Tribunal during cases under the Act. This clause again is designed generally to replicate the effect of the provision of the Equal Opportunities Act 2006 and the Employment Act. The Industrial Tribunal can make a declaration regarding the rights of the complainant and or the respondent, or the compensation to be paid, including damages for injury to feelings, and make an appropriate recommendation. The measure of compensation is that which applies in tort claims, for example, claims of negligence, where the compensation for performance in the same position as far as possible, as he or she would have been in if the unlawful act had not taken place. Clause 10 provides that in any claim where a person alleges bullying or victimization under the Act, the burden of proving his or her case starts with the claimant. Once the claimant has established sufficient facts, which in the absence of any other explanation points to a breach having occurred, the burden shifts to the respondent to show that he or she did not meet the relevant provisions of the Act. Clause 11 sets out how interest to any award of compensation made to the claimant as a result of the case brought under the Act shall be calculated. This clause again replicates the provisions of the Equal Opportunities Act 2006. Finally, the schedule provides for the bullying at work policy, which I referred to earlier. Mr. Speaker, this bill will not come into operation until a notice is published in the Gazette to commence it. The government welcomes that employers' organizations, like the Federation of Small Businesses and the Chamber of Commerce, are supportive of the work being done to rid the workplace of bullying. In order to ensure that commencement of the bill does not, however, give rise to spurious claims and to enable employers and employees to prepare for this landmark legislation, I have established a commencement committee which will include the union, DAWN and the GFSB and the Chamber to enable us all to work together in ensuring this legislation comes into operation as effectively as possible. I have this morning, Mr. Speaker, I will in fact this morning, in a moment, circulate a letter with minor typographical amendments to the language of the bill which we will raise at the committee stage. Mr. Speaker, the very first leaflet we issued during the course of the 2011 general election campaign carried a simple and effective message that demonstrated our commitment to banning bullying in the workplace. The message was ban the bully. This bill does just that. For that purpose, Mr. Speaker, I commend the bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any other member wish to speak in the general principles and merits of the bill? The Honourable Alan Bocina.
Mr. Speaker, I've spent considerable time and effort in reviewing this particular bill because I think it is a very important legislative move on behalf of the government. And in fact, I've the information I'll be reading from some notes I have here with me. But it is precisely, Mr. Speaker, because it is such a groundbreaking and I would describe it also revolutionary in nature, that I think, and certainly on this side of the House, we think that much more should have been done to educate, inform, and advise employees, and importantly, employers about this particular piece of legislation. There should have been, in my consideration, much more consultation. I've spoken recently in preparation, in my preparation for this day, to various employers and other interested parties and stakeholders, and many of them, Mr. Speaker, are unaware of the existence of this bill, or in some cases, its far-reaching terms. One has to acknowledge the sterling work which has been done by a particular local pressure group by the name of Dignity at Work Now, that is Dawn for Thought, and one of its main proponents, Mr. Francis Bugaboo, whom I recently had the pleasure to meet to discuss this bill. He has done a very good work over the years in both bringing this delicate issue to the fore and also in counselling and advising people affected by this scar on society that is bullying. Generally, but in particular, particularly in the workplace, has to be recognised by everybody in the fight. There have, of course, Mr. Speaker, been many pressure groups outside of Gibraltar, and particularly in the UK, which have also done a lot of work in this area. But, as I said earlier, in our view, a lot more could and should have been done by the government in the lead up to this legislation. By way of analogy, I recall when Lord Wolfe spearheaded the radical changes to the Supreme Court rules, which heralded the introduction of the, I guess if I could describe them, the new civil procedure rules, but of course they've been in place now for a considerable period of time in 1999. Members of the legal profession will recall that we had conferences, seminars, and symposiums, which were held in Gibraltar in anticipation of the rules application here. That was indeed very informative for local practitioners who were able to digest their meat and the substance of the rules before their implementation. As a collective, members of the bar, the judiciary, and other court service users and staff were able to prepare for the radical changes which the reforms brought in their wake. As far as the opposition can see, there has been none or at least little of that here. Very few shop owners, small business owners, or indeed even practitioners of employment law, Mr. Speaker, have been made aware of the proposed radical nature of these changes. And this, Mr. Speaker, is an important point, because certainly from the perspective of the, for example, small business owner, who is already facing the very considerable reduction in sales as a result of the frontier queues, is now having imposing him more stringent burdens in the form of legislation. And this is not just in the context of the implementation of the bullying at work policy as set out in the schedule to the Act, which, indeed, I'll go into that later, has been cited in the House of Commons as being unenforceable in nature, but a policy which has been applied, in fact, that particular policy, which the Honourable Chief Minister alluded to, is a policy which has to be applied by all employers, irrespective of their size, but also because they could be subjected to unmeritorious claims without being able to recover the cost from such claims, given that the jurisdiction where these complaints are going to be heard is in the Investment Tribunal, where cost recovery, as honourable members who are practitioners or work practitioners in this area will know, is very, very difficult indeed. Europe-wide, there are different stages of development in relation to this area of law. Sweden, for example, was the first country to legislate in this area in 1993. There have been European-wide legislative moves in the areas of equal opportunities, which the Honourable Chief Minister referred us to, which enshrined what in broad terms can be referred to as anti-discrimination provisions, where there is a prohibition of bullying and victimization in a set of protected characteristics, such as sex, religion, age, etc. That is already part of the Gibraltar statute, in the form of the Equal Opportunities Act. In the UK, there have been various attempts at introducing what they call, and we used to call, the Dignity at Work legislation, which, although approved in the House of Lords in 2001, has not been implemented in the House of Commons to date. In England, as here, Mr. Speaker, we have the ability not only to bring claims under the Equal Opportunities legislation, the common law, but also in relation to health and safety legislative architecture. One particular campaigner, Ms. Valerie Davey, the MP for Bristol West, in the 2001-2005 UK Parliament, carried out a personal campaign by persisting over many years to ensure that there was a debate on this issue in the House of Commons, having first applied for a motion in 2001, but which was not in fact debated until 2003. We, however, found cross-party support for the Abtel campaign when the matter was finally aired. In her 2003 speech, she spoke of the harrowing experiences that employees across the country undergo at the hands of bullies in the workplace. The statistics we used then were quite shocking to read. A study carried out by the University of Manchester in 2001 showed that 10% of people had experienced bullying during the previous 6 months, while 25% had experienced it in the previous 5 years. Gibraltar, unfortunately, is not apparently free of such bullying. The information available in the Dawn website, the local pressure group, refers us to a preliminary study which shows that 31.1% of employees consider themselves victims of bullying at work, and we also have the sad case of one suicide. However, what many people have asked is what other empirical evidence is there of bullying in Gibraltar? What information, if any, is available to the employment service? What statistics does the government have? None, I suspect. And this is one further area of concern as to how this delicate issue is being handled. The now governing party already had draft legislation in place and were already committed to legislation before, in my view, studying the matter more carefully. They had the pill ready before they even knew how big the ailment, in fact, is or was in Gibraltar. For all these reasons, this issue should have been properly debated and the community properly educated. I am conscious that this is a manifesto commitment of the government, but there is no reason why the debate could not have been taken place before the legislation was brought to the House. I also, Mr. Speaker, have concerns with the details of the bill as it currently stands, and whether, therefore, we are introducing good law for what is such an important and delicate subject. I really do get the impression that the government is pursuing this initiative without much thought. It is obsessing with ticking that particular box of its manifesto. Firstly, and as stated earlier, I am not sure that there has been wide consultation or indeed enough time given for such consultation, given that the bill represents a substantial departure from the command paper which was published in January 2012, within a month after the current party was elected into government. The command paper is expressed, for example, in terms of dignity at work, as opposed to bullying or victimization, which follows the UK bill. Secondly, we seem to have gone on a frolic of our own by mixing the wording set out in the UK Dignity at Work Bill, Equal Opportunities Legislation, and Prevention of Harassment, the UK Prevention of Harassment Act wording, all in one motion pot. And I'm not sure how that will work in terms of enforcement and interpretation. I'm not sure whether this is what informed his decision, but when the Leader of Opposition was the Minister of Justice and he introduced a considerable number of legislative changes, as a petitioner, what I always noticed was that they were very similar in terms to the English legislation, which for a petitioner makes a lot of sense because you can at least apply the common law architecture which is available in the UK to Gibraltar. Where you have a wholesale adoption of the equal opportunity legislation is in relation to the remedy section clause 9 of the bill and the interest on compensation set out at clause 11 section, which provides, for example, for the Supreme Court compensation and injury proceedings. The statutory cap here, Mr. Speaker, is removed in circumstances where the legislation is of much wider scope, because the bullying or victimization is not required to be based, as I said earlier, on a protected characteristic as it is in the current equal opportunity legislation. Could at least, as an initial move, the government must have adopted a non-punitive approach, as in the case, for example, in Sweden, where in fact there was an MP in the UK by the name of Mr. John Robertson, who, during the course of the debate on the 25th of March 2003, encouraged the UK government at the time to follow that particular route. Importantly, Mr. Speaker, the cost would deem applicable in relation to unfairness which is claimed, i.e. they are, for all intents and purposes, non-payable, apply to complaints of this nature. So that, for example, a small business employer could be subjected to an unmeritorious claim which would require defending at cost to it, which would then not be recovered, with medical reports and all other sorts of expenses. An unmeritorious claim, Mr. Speaker, to a small business employer employing, let's say, one or two employees, could ruin the business. The other point is the industrial tribunal the appropriate body to deal with claims of this nature? A chairman will now be required to deal with Supreme Court level compensation. Can the tribunal deal with these matters administratively? Question whether this makes a question that I do have is whether this in fact makes matters worse for claimants. Will they not also be precluded as a result from claiming such compensation from the Supreme Court in an ordinary claim? It should be borne in mind that claims under the Protection of the Harassment Act of 1997 in England and Wales can only be brought in the High Court in England. Section 4.1 refers to, sorry, Clause 4.1, I beg your pardon, Mr. Speaker, refers to a conduct. It's now a point I would wish to raise with the Honourable Gentlemen and Ladies. And this is this. There's no further explanation as to whether the conduct is expected to be repetitive or not. Could that not be, for example, a reference to a course of conduct, which I think is the legislative language in the Protection of Harassment Act? I understand, Mr. Speaker, that in Sweden, for example, they outlawed recurrent, reprehensible, or distinctively negative actions, using the word, in fact, using the particular section there. Much of the literature that I have read on the subject refers to repeated and persistent behavior, which is what is in fact envisaged in most of the examples set out in Clause 4.2, but not all of them. Protection of Harassment Act requires there to be a course of conduct, as I said earlier. Whilst on the subject of the Protection of Harassment Act, I would ask the Honourable Chief Minister in the course of his reply, given that it is a manifesto commitment of the government to also include a protection of, I'm reading direct from the manifesto, says this will also include a Protection of Harassment Act, and whether it is the intention of the government as part of this legislative program to the course of the parliament to introduce a second act in relation to Protection of Harassment, or whether he considers that the relevant provisions are already set out in this particular bill. I'd be grateful for some guidance in relation to that point. The suggested amendment I've just made in relation to the course of conduct would also go some way to address concerns which employers will no doubt have of being at the end of serious claims, as I mentioned earlier, as a result of one-off actions. I dare say, Mr. Speaker, that even the local pressure group would also agree with the definition of bullying as being repetitive or using the words of the draft legislation, persistent behavior. Should the word, Mr. Speaker, and it may be one of the suggested amendments that the Honourable Chief Minister referred to earlier, the word reasonable not also be included before justification in Clause 4.2.C, I would ask him to consider that. In relation to third party, I'd like to put Honourable Members to Clause 6.4, which deals with basically the employer having to protect employees from third-party bullying. Is the government contemplating legislation for those acts of bullying perpetrated by non-employees on employees? Is the question I have. I think on the face of the wording of the legislation, I think the answer must be yes. And of course, this can lead to a situation, Mr. Speaker, where, for example, a contractor has employees working on a construction site, and that particular employee is bullied by a tenant. That contractor or employer will be held liable under the Act. In a legal firm situation, where, for example, a partner may be, or a legal firm may be the subject of a claim by an associate if the associate is bullied by a client. Things like that, which I think ought to have been given sufficient thought to. How is it proposed, Mr. Speaker, that A, i.e. the employer, will know of these bullying? I know that there is no specific provision which allows for the giving of notice by, say, a B to A, for example. The other point is, has thought been given to the difference in the use of language and therefore potentially legal text in the use of the word detriment in clause 7D and less favorable treatment in clause 5? Because I think those two clauses sort of work with each other. I'll ask you on the two minutes, maybe Mrs. Pyway could address concerns on relation to this. In relation to clauses, this may be at one of the type of classical errors which the other two minutes are referring to. In clause 9, there is a reference, so clause 9.1, we have three subsections, which are A, B, and then there's a sort of big I, and that also be a small C, with a consequential change to clause 9. Which has been for that particular subsection. Moving on to the schedule to the bill, which sets out the bullying at work policy, as I said earlier, this requires a mandatory implementation by all employers, irrespective of the size of the undertaking. And what cost burden will this imply for these employers? Will they not have to seek legal advice in terms of the drafting of these documents, for example? And this is, in fact, a crucially important part of the legislation, given that it affords a defense to employers under Clause 6.5. Provision 2D in the bullying at work policy talks of a designation of a competent person to whom complaints should be made. There's no definition of what a competent person is. What guidance is being offered to employers, especially those, as I said, as repeated during the course of my speech, who run small businesses, which are the vast majority of employers in Gibraltar, as to who this competent person should be. Will they need to employ somebody else? Does the person have to be qualified? If so, in what? Reference is also made, Mr. Speaker, to F. To providing details of designated persons in approval, which are therefore available to counsel, etc. Again, what guidance is there as to who those persons should be? Mr. Speaker, the legislation which the MPA referred to earlier, Ms. Davies, thought introduced by an amendment. I think it was the Employment Relations Bill on the 9th of March 2004, in Clause 1, is in fact in very similar terms to Clause 4 of the current bill, although it talks about the protection of the right to dignity at work. But it almost word for word what is provided for the amendment which we thought introduced was almost word for word, if not word for word, was set out in the schedule to this particular bill. She, in fact, withdrew that particular clause on the basis of the government at the time was to launch, together with Amethyst, the, and I quote, world's largest project to stamp out the bullying and discrimination at work. She then said, I offer my sincere congratulations to my right honourable friend, the Secretary of State, on her announcement last week that, together with Amethyst, the government will launch the world's largest project to stamp out bullying and discrimination at work. The project has been launched to provide supportive advice and training to organizations that are trying to tackle bullying, train employees as counselors, to devise and promote a voluntary charter and dignity at work, promote examples of excellent employers in the United Kingdom, and produce a benchmark that enables organizations to measure the success in achieving dignity at work and a ban bullying plan. The governments are working initially with Amethyst and 10 leading employers, including British Aerospace, Ryanair, and then he refers to the other employers. Ms. Eleanor Lang then said, from the Conservative opposition at the time, although I entirely agree with her sentiments and intentions, I disagree with the idea that passing further legislation will achieve them. The clause is too prescriptive, the same clause as the bullying at work policy. Clearly, I do not have to make that argument because she acknowledges its validity, and that is because, in fact, Ms. Davies withdrew the amendment. New Clause 1 would place an enormous burden on employers and employees to understand what constitutes a dignity at work policy and the way in which it would be enforced. That applies especially to a small workplace in a small or medium-sized firm that does not employ many human resources people. It can be good for industry to employ more people to deal with further regulations than it does to manufacture goods and services. Business and industry should be about the latter, not about not keeping to the letter of complicated laws. If the solution to the enormous problem that you described was part of such a law, we would be pleased. Employers and employees alike would be pleased if we could eradicate the dreadful problem of bullying by merely writing something in statute. It would be bad jurisprudence to pass new clause 1 into law, as it would be difficult to enforce. It is bad in principle to make laws that cannot be enforced and would be unclear. Mr. Speaker, in another debate, later on, I think it was in 2004, Dr. Vince Cable, said that he was struck by the comments made by the Andrea Adams Trust with the Honourable Member for Bristol West Canterbury, from Australia, referred to earlier. And it asks, does the court room really have to be the appropriate battleground? Surely, in reality, the ideal place to resolve the problem must be in the workplace itself. Recognition and awareness of workplace bullying is essential if we are to move forward. Whether or not there may be a case for workplace legislation, the report said that a concerted effort should be made by management and the union to raise the profile of workplace bullying to ensure that it is properly monitored. And then he referred to the fact that there are legal remedies which exist, which are very similar to the legal remedies which are available in Gibraltar. And then he says, if there were a role for legislation, perhaps it is not laying down prescriptive procedures to deal with workplace bullying, but placing an obligation on employers to have an anti-bullying policy and to allow for flexibility in that policy to deal with particular problems. I don't think that this particular bill achieves that, Mr. Speaker. And these are precisely the criticisms that we on the opposition side have in relation to this legislation in general, specifically to the third rule to the bill, which is entitled the Bullying at Work Authority. Mr. Speaker, rather than proceed by way of legislation, for example, should the government not have proceeded in a similar way to the UK and engaged with the industry? Or perhaps also, if legislation is the way to proceed, to have adopted the Swedish example of non-punitive measures, as I mentioned earlier. It is interesting, I would point out, given the social credentials of members opposite, that it isn't Labour Party policy and it actually didn't feature in the 2010 election manifesto. It is for all of these reasons, Mr. Speaker, that unless I'm persuaded by the Honourable the Chief Minister's reply to what he's about to say, that I think we have little alternative but to abstain on this particular legislative initiative. And it is a pity because had things been done in a different way and properly, it would no doubt have resulted in support from this area.
Does any other Honourable Member wish to contribute to the second reading of the bill? Otherwise, I will call upon the mover to reply. The Honourable Deputy Minister.
Mr. Speaker, it really is quite astonishing to have heard the extraordinary remarks that the Honourable Member has made. It is quite a riddle through, pretending to support something that is designed to protect those who are being bullied in the workplace, while trying to find every possible reason to object to raising their hands at the end in support of this. I really do not know what it is that they think that they're doing. Is it that they're trying desperately to be in the good book of the employers' organisations, but not annoying the employee organisations? So that's a sort of tightrope that they're trying to walk with these games. Well, I think it is so transparent and sincere that it is not going to get them anywhere. Mr. Speaker, let's be very clear about what has happened and how the Honourable Gentleman has tried to pretend the opposite. We have published, within 100 days of being elected, a command paper on a subject that, even by the Honourable Member's intervention, he accepts deals with something that is sensitive and affects some people's daily lives. He seems accepted that there are statistics available internationally and in Gibraltar carried out by a group that he has said he respects, although he doesn't appear to have put much more by their statistics, that show that there is bullying in the workplace in Gibraltar. So we publish a command paper in 2012. We publish an amended bill as a result of having published that command paper and having consulted, a very different bill to the command paper as a result of the consultation in 2013. And in 2014, the old member gets up and says, "We haven't consulted enough." Well, Speaker, if we change the command paper, because we do consult, and we produce a bill that is different because we do consult, doesn't that demonstrate that the fruit of that work is what is before the Parliament today, and it is therefore the bill that results in the consultation? How can you say we haven't consulted enough? Well, I dare say that the fact is that they haven't engaged in the consultation. It appears to me that Mr. Bettina spent much of last night trying to read up and debate anywhere else in the European Union that he might be able to lay his hands on to have something to say. Because we haven't had him address what he's been doing for the past 2 years with the command paper published and who he's spoken to in the past 2 years. By his own mouth, he's told us that in the past couple of days he's phoned a few people who are employers. And then he's given us his own summary of the debates that he's read in another place. Well, I don't think that is consultation leading to proper decision making to make a stand on something as important as this, which leads them to abstain.
Well, I think members of the general public will make up their own minds about how serious their protestations of support for the principles and general merits of the bill are, given their response in this second reading. And then, if you forget, the Honourable Gentleman tells us we should have done more by way of guidance and information, and he puts this in mind of the work done in relation to the Wolf reforms, as they were known. He is a bit of a wolf in sheep's clothing, speaking in this debate, I put it to him, whilst he pretends he wants to protect those who are bullied, but doesn't want to support the legislation that does it. So the work reforms, which are the civil procedure reforms, he says, they were properly dealt with. There were seminars and there were guidance notes and there were conferences. Yes, it's a secret that way. After the bill to make those changes to the rules had passed the Westminster Parliament or had been adopted as what petitioners know as the new White Book. So the rules were in place. It wasn't a question of the rules not being made whilst there were conferences and guidance notes and discussions. All of it was done. And then there was guidance and conferences and discussions. But I can see what happened to the Honourable Gentleman in his speech. He wrote it before he heard my speech. And the fact that his pen had been so worried in writing the speech that he wanted to read it anyway, or he just didn't listen to what I had to say. I said there will be a commencement committee and the bill will not commence until the commencement committee advises me to commence it. And what the commencement committee will do is provide guidance and provide training and help employers and help employees. All the things that he said that we should be doing, which I had just said we were going to do. So I will take Mr. Speaker with a proverbial pinch of salt everything that came after. Because if he is advising me to do that which I have said I am doing, he's not giving me the sort of advice that I could be persuaded to pay for if I was instructing him professionally. Mr. Speaker, small business owners in Gibraltar have never had a more listening government. And despite the fact that this bill has been published as a command paper for 2 years and in its current form for some time, and that it was published actually as a bill in December of last year, this is not a bill which has only been published for 6 weeks, it's now been published for almost 12 weeks or even longer. We are still talking to the employer organization, not to one or two employers, like he referred to his conversation,
but to the employer organization. Comes to the employee organization. And we are putting the employer organizations and the employee organizations and the government in the same committee to work on guidance and the best way to implement this bill. And therefore, this presents that he is somehow representing the interest of the small business owner of the business with two or three employees, really wears very thin when one looks at what is actually happening on the government side. They don't need protection from this government, Mr. Speaker. This government is the ally of small businesses and the ally of those small businesses abroad, regardless of the size of the undertaking, because they are the ones who provide jobs. And in doing the work of presenting this bill to the Parliament, of course we are not just protecting the bully, we're also protecting the employer, because what productivity in a workplace where bullying is rife, or where an employee who is there to produce is subject to such bullying that he cannot give the best of himself? So this is in effect also in the interest of the employer. But Mr. Speaker, there should be perhaps no surprise whatsoever that they've taken the attitude that they've taken. And in their abstention, on this side of the House, we will hear them voting against this bill. Because in effect, they have 15 years in government to consult, to think, to talk to Dawn, that they never talked to when they were in government. And only last week, he had the pleasure of welcoming to his office. Well, those of us who are on this side of the House have been working with them for almost half a decade, concerned about the issues that they raise. Because all of the florid words to justify the unjustifiable abstention today are about the nuclear deal and what the nuclear deal has done in the past 72 hours or in the past week to try and deal with this difficult issue. But not about what the old GOP was up to for 60 years and their failure to address this issue, at least since Dawn put it on the agenda. Perhaps I shouldn't be surprised, Mr. Speaker, given that in almost every public intervention that honourable members make, they try and decry the things that their party did whilst in government and tell us how new and how different they are, and how new and how different even their internal procedures are, Mr. Speaker. Although they are uncannily similar to those internal procedures that those of us on this side of the House in the GFOP have been pursuing for many, many years since we were established. But anyway, the history lesson that the Honourable Gentleman gives us as to the progress of anti-bullying legislation through other parliaments, he should know, is one that we have done already ourselves before the command paper and even before being in government. It doesn't take a Seneca, and that name is the same in English as it is in Spanish, Mr. Speaker, because it is Greek, to be able to work out what to type into Google to get now the debate that one has access to in all of the parliaments around Europe that deal with these issues. But everything he told us was just that. It was historical, it was anecdotal, it was this attempt to justify what they're going to do. They're going to keep their hands down. They're going to keep their mouths shut when this Parliament gives them, for the first time in history, the opportunity to support a measure that will ban bullying. That's what they're going to do. And the Honourable Gentleman just could not find enough words to try and decorate that this reputable silence that is going to characterize their approach to this legislation when they have the opportunity to vote. Mr. Speaker, we've looked at that history, we've looked at those debates, we've engaged with Dawn, we've engaged with the employers, we've engaged with the employees, and this bill is the product of that consultation. And the commencement committee will take us even further in providing guidance and deciding how best to assist with the implementation of the principles that are set out in this bill. Because, Mr. Speaker, of course there is evidence of bullying in the workplace in Gibraltar. But our first leaflet
in the general election campaign, but our first advertisement in the general election campaign of 2011 highlighted the issue of bullying. It at least have highlighted to them, during the campaign at least, that our first command paper dealt with this issue. Should have highlighted to them, in opposition, the breadth of the representation made to us about how widespread this problem has become. The Labour gentleman seems to quote with approval the statistics provided to him by Dawn, but then said, why haven't you done your own survey? Well, Mr. Speaker, one suicide is one suicide too many. That's a statistic that should sit in all of our minds today when we decide how we vote on this bill. To a great extent, whether a leader of a parliament says this is an issue of conscience or not, whether a leader of a party says this is an issue of conscience or not, every bill that we make, a legislative measure, that we make an act, that we make a law, is a matter on our conscience. Whether it deals with taxation, which affects people's pockets, or whether it deals with issues that can affect daily life in a different way, every time we vote to make an act, this must be something on our conscience, because we're making laws for the people who are not in this parliament and who look to us to regulate the relationships between us in this community. And if there has been one suicide attributable to bullying at work, what more statistics do the honourable members want before they decide to support this and to act? It's about needing guidance and needing to do all the work that we have agreed, and I said we have agreed, should happen during the course of the work of this commencement committee, is not a reason to delay the legislation. I don't discount, Mr. Speaker, that we could come back in the future and amend the legislation as a result of the work of the commencement committee or otherwise, like every piece of legislation, because we've had bumper pieces of legislation. Sources of huge pride for those representatives. And you prime that, Mr. Speaker, that the Honourable Minister for Justice, before he was leader of the opposition on that side of the House, made. And we have to amend that, Mr. Speaker. We have to amend a lot of pieces of legislation because things change because of the operation of the legislation, because legislation needs to be updated. We should be amending more. There are statutes in our statute book that require attention because of levels of fines or levels of payment, etc. And maybe that this, which is the honourable gentleman says, is a homegrown piece of legislation, will require amendment in the future. So be it. I don't discount that. It may be that we need to tighten in some areas that he has suggested that we should loosen. It may be that we need to loosen in some of the areas that he has not suggested that we should loosen. So, Mr. Speaker, I think that, and he's even suggested in one particular remark that we should tighten a particular area by the introduction of the concept of reasonableness before a justification. So, it may be that all of those things are relevant in the future, but not a reason not to progress with this legislation today. And because he was genuine in what he was saying, if he were genuine in what he was saying, because he likes to present himself as the genuine face of the GFP, as you're wearing on, Mr. Speaker, a nice guy. Why haven't you written to me and said, Fabian, I really want to support this legislation. This is an important thing that deals with the bullies at work. These are the issues which I think would make the bill better. If he were genuine, Mr. Speaker, he would have done that, and he has not. He has wanted to use all of these little hooks in this legislative intervention, which is almost an attempt at what we might call, now that we know more about Britain, a palindrome speech with many hooks in it, to try and get himself off the hook of why he's not going to support this landmark piece of legislation. I don't think there's much merit in the interpretation that he wanted us to consider of what happens in relation to associates in a law firm, Mr. Speaker. Many of them are actually not employed, they're self-employed individuals. But of course there are issues with fixing employers and liability for what third parties do. But this is not the only legislation that does it. Of course, in the same way as an employer has vicarious liability for the acts of his employees, he sometimes has to carry liability if his employee is subject to injury. And this is just dealing with exactly that principle. So let no employer think that Mr. Bottini is their representative in this place protecting them from a new concept of liability. Because if even he believes that, he's got this completely wrong and he should know better. No question, Mr. Speaker, of employers needing to employ somebody to be the competent person in Schedule 1. If he's read the bill in detail, he will see that the competent person in Schedule 1 just needs to know what the procedures are and understand what it is that the anti-bullying protocols that a particular employer may have in place are there for. And it is, Mr. Speaker, as he has noted, at least in one part of his intervention, a defense to a claim in respect of bullying to have had such a procedure in place. And the simplest model for him to understand, Mr. Speaker, that we base this on, is the model, for example, of anti-money laundering. Small companies, Mr. Speaker, even those who choose to pretend to represent maybe two or three employees, they all have to be ready to deal with money laundering issues. When one deals with issues like this, which are all pervasive, you don't say, and this will not apply to a three-member firm or a three-man company or somebody trading with a small group of employees. Of course it applies. And you have a policy that deals with this issue that you know about. It sounds so difficult, maybe when it's being considered in the context of the parliament, an anti-money laundering policy. My goodness, how am I going to deal with that? I've got a paint shop. How am I going to deal with an anti-money laundering policy? I've got three employees. Who's going to be the anti-money laundering officer? Well, at the end of the day, we all have to be on guard in relation to these issues, regardless of the industry in which one is. It's much more important in the financial services sector than it is in the paint shop. But nobody can launder money today, and nobody's employee can launder money today. So this is not new ground that we're making here. Speaker, before I say a little bit more about these issues, the Honourable Gentleman talked about the protection of harassment issues that are in our manifesto, and that were dealt with originally, or were going to be dealt with originally with this legislation, and they're not. In fact, Mr. Speaker, those have already been dealt with. I'm surprised he asked us how we intend to deal with that. I mean, I know that he's only been here 2 years, but I would have thought the 2 years that he's been here, he's been paying attention. The hate crimes legislation has already dealt with those issues. I know the Minister for Justice is able to give us more guidance on that, and I'm happy to give way to him so that he can explain the detail of how that's been dealt with. Yes, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member has referred to a provision in my manifesto, which deals with this that we're dealing with today, and says there will also be a Protection of Harassment Act. And the Honourable Member will know, or should know, that there have been several measures taken already in respect of harassment. The CRIMES Act, which was a piece of legislation enacted in this parliament at the time when the Leader of the Opposition was Minister for Justice, contains Part 6, which precisely inhibits protection from harassment. So there are protection from harassment provisions which were enacted during the DOD standard, which we commenced in, in November 2012. But we haven't just done that. We haven't just commenced legislation on a part dealing with commencement from harassment, which was there already. What we did was we reviewed how this legislation was actually working in practice in the UK, the Protection of Harassment from Harassment Act in the UK. And what we have done is introduce new provisions into that part six of the CRIMES Act, additional provisions to those which were already there. And these provisions, one of them which I dealt with quite recently here in Parliament, was the stalking provision, which is an entirely new provision. It's a part of harassment.
May I give some guidance in this matter? Here we have a bill that deals with bullying and associated methods, right? There was a comment by the Honourable Mr. Bottino about the question of harassment, which is a separate issue and is not being provided for in this bill. The Chief Minister has invited the Honourable Minister for Justice to explain what the government has done, but we really have to be brief about it. You know, we cannot have a debate about harassment on a bill which is for another purpose. So I would invite the Honourable Member to continue the work with him, but to be brief, and we are not going to have a debate about harassment.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, it's not certainly our intention to have a debate, but simply to answer the point as
include the question of stalking and also a new offence of harassment of a person in his own home. That is a new offence which we introduced because this thing wasn't there already. I would remind the Honourable Member that in both provisions, in that part of the Crimes Act, which are essentially criminal offences, there is also provision for civil remedies. Section 93 in particular also introduces that. And as the Honourable Chief Minister has mentioned, we have gone even much further than that, because we have introduced in one of the parts in the Crimes Act further provisions in relation to hate crimes. And those provisions include specific provisions which deal with religiously aggravated harassment, disability aggravated harassment, aggravated harassment by reason of sexual orientation, and age aggravated harassment. Again, all new provisions which we have introduced as part of our anti-harassment policy. So although it is true that what we have not done is taken all of those and put it in a separate box, we considered that it was appropriate, given that there was statutory provision already, simply to add these provisions, and there were civil remedies already provided. So we have kept it in the Crimes Act, added to that statutory framework, and that is the extent to which we have gone in introducing the protection of harassment, which we committed ourselves in our manifesto to do, and which we have now fully done. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, for all of those reasons, a very good opportunity for the Deputy Chief Minister to ensure that he ticks that box in respect of our manifesto commitment completely. They don't like the fact that we are completing all of the provisions of our manifesto. They don't like it. They even say that we say that we've done things and that we tick off boxes, but they are nonsensical because we said that we took the box of continuing to provide grants to students. Well, Mr. Speaker, apparently, it's nonsensical when we took that box and we've done it. But it's not nonsensical for them to put it in their book of 16 years of achievement, but it wasn't their achievement, it was the achievement of their government before, and to put in their manifesto for 2011 that they were going to continue to give those grants. So much for their criticism of our box ticking. But anyway, Mr. Speaker, I will deal with the issue that the Honourable Gentleman raised at the detail of the section of the draft legislation during the course of the committee stage and third reading if he wants to raise those issues. Mr. Speaker, this legislation protects small businesses and large businesses. It protects employers and it protects employees. It protects every potential individual, company, firm that this Parliament should want to be protected. But it denudes of protection the bullies who have not had to deal with legislative control until now. And it's a bill that is carefully crafted to achieve those purposes and to deal with an issue that, as we've heard, has already become far too pervasive. It puts bullies in their place and it protects small and large employers and all employees. But let's be clear, Mr. Speaker. We are moving proactively from this side of the House to provide that protection. And members of this are looking for a way of obstructing this. So be it. Say it. Let the public know. Let the public know what it is that members of this are not going to support prohibiting. Let the public know what it is that members of this apparently do not stand against. Let the public know, Mr. Speaker, that the opposition are not going to support legislation designed to prohibit persistent behaviour which is offensive, intimidating, abusive, malicious, or insulting. Let the public know that they don't want to stop persistent, unjustified criticism. Let the public know that they don't want to stop punishment being imposed without justification. Let the public realise, Mr. Speaker, that they don't want to stop people having changes in their duties or responsibilities to their detriment without reasonable justification. Mr. Speaker, we stand for stopping all of that. They've just told us that they should cop out again.
I now put the question, which is whether a bill for an act to prohibit bullying and victimization in employment and for connected purposes be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? The opposition abstain and carried.
The Employment Bullying at Work Act 2013.
Speaker, I have I'd like to give notice that the committee statement third reading of the bill be taken today, all honourable members of this.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee statement third reading of the bill be taken today?
A bill for an act to amend the Tobacco Act 1997, the honourable deputy senator.
Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Tobacco Act 1997 be read the first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Tobacco Act 1997 be read the first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Tobacco Amendment Act 2014.
Speaker, I have the honour to move that the Bill for an Act to amend the Tobacco Act 1997 be now read a second time. Speaker, this bill amends the Tobacco Act 1997 so as to create new summary offences of concealing cigarettes or being knowingly concerned with the concealment of cigarettes within a motor vehicle and being in charge of a motor vehicle in which cigarettes are concealed. The offence does not require there to be a commercial quantity involved, although this does affect the penalty, or for the offence to take place in a public place or within a designated zone. The term conceal is defined in the amendment as meaning placing cigarettes within a compartment or place adapted, altered or fitted in any manner for the purpose of concealing goods, placing cigarettes within the engine compartment of a vehicle, or placing cigarettes within the bodywork, wheels or tyres of a vehicle. As such, simply placing cigarettes in the boot or glove box of a car or under a seat is not caused by this offence. The penalties for these offences are in line with those for other offences under the Tobacco Act. Imprisonment is not available as a sentencing option where the quantity of cigarettes involved is not a commercial quantity. The amendments included in Clause 2.3 place the forfeiture of tobacco and motor vehicles to which the offence relates on the same basis as the forfeiture of tobacco and motor vehicles to which the offence of transportation of a commercial quantity of tobacco relates. The court must order forfeiture when an application is made in that respect by the Attorney General or the prosecuting officer, as is the case at the moment under the existing provisions of the Act. Mr. Speaker, honourable members will have seen a letter circulated yesterday by me certifying the bill is too urgent to await the 6-week publication period before it can be proceeded with. The issue of the trade in tobacco is, as honourable members know, the subject of a letter from the European Commission arising from their inspection of the front of control illegally imposed by Spain. The government has taken and will be taking measures to implement the recommendations of the European Commission and to go further even than those recommendations in the curtailing of the illicit tobacco activity. This is one such measure, and the government has wanted to ensure it is in place as soon as possible. The bill, Mr. Speaker, was published on the 30th of January, and the abridgment is therefore of 3 weeks, and is very much in Gibraltar's public interest, in our view, that it should be taken today. I commend the bill to you.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill?
Speaker, very briefly, Mr. Speaker, the opposition will be supporting the bill. Indeed, the opposition will be supporting any legislative measure introduced by the government that keeps a handle or help in dealing with what is a problem for this jurisdiction, a reputational problem for this jurisdiction. In the sites that we see, that everybody sees at different points in Gibraltar with this particular illicit activity. I said as much in September of 2012 when I urged the government to deal with the issue of the selling of tobacco in a state. I'm glad that the government has also dealt with that. And as I say, that any measure introduced by the government that deals with what is a problem and a reputational problem for Gibraltar, the opposition will support not only now but also in future.
speaker, I'm grateful to the Honourable Lady of the Opposition for having set the position out as we have. The government is taking steps, not just which require action in this House, but some of which do not require action in this House, and the exercise of powers already granted to the government under the Tobacco Act and other legislative enactments in order to deal with these issues. These issues have been a problem in Gibraltar for a long time, but this government will grab the nettle. We will deal with the issues. We have done so in Laguna Estate and in Grafton Estate through the commissioners, the collective customs exercise of his discretion to control the retailing of tobacco in those estates in a particular fashion. I have certified and created new red zones under the Tobacco Act in the area of the beaches in Gibraltar, in the area of the frontier, in order to control that activity. And my hands will not shake if I have to sign into law other measures to enable our law enforcement officers to have the powers necessary to take the action required to curtail activity which is undertaken.
And my further question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Tobacco Act 1997 be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Tobacco Amendment Act 2014.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to give notice that the committee statement and third reading of the bill be taken today with all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee statement and third reading of the bill be taken today?
A bill for an act to implement the Convention on Mutual Administrative Assistance in Tax Matters of the 21st of January 1988, as amended by the protocol amending the Convention on Mutual Administrative Assistance in Tax Matters of the 27th of May 2010, and for connected purposes. The Honourable Minister.
I have the honour to move that the bill for an act to implement the Convention on Mutual Administrative Assistance in Tax Matters of the 21st of January 1988, as amended by the protocol amending the Convention on Mutual Administrative Assistance in Tax Matters of the 27th of May 2010, and for connected purposes, be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to implement the Convention on Mutual Administrative Assistance in Tax Matters of the 21st of January 1988, as amended by the protocol amending the Convention on Mutual Administrative Assistance in Tax Matters of the 27th of May 2010, and for connected purposes, be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Taxation Mutual Administrative Assistance Act 2014.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill be now read a second time. The Speaker, the Taxation Mutual Administrative Assistance Act 2014 implements the OECD and the Council of Europe Convention on Mutual Administrative Assistance in Tax Matters of the 21st of January 1988, as amended by the protocol. A measure of similar cooperation as that created by this Act already exists with some states, Mr. Speaker, by virtue of the tiers that Gibraltar has already entered into. Tiers, Mr. Speaker, are tax information exchange agreements. And the usefulness of these is well recognised. The extension of this convention to Gibraltar extends that network of peer equivalent relationships enormously through the effective international cooperation which this multilateral convention creates between a large number of states and through the uniform application and interpretation of its provisions. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, the bill is framed so as to provide administrative cooperation between states by way of exchange of information and with respect to taxes on income and profits, and in particular with a view to combating tax avoidance and evasion. Mr. Speaker, I'm going to take the House with what I hope will be a quick review of some of the relevant sections of this Act. The declaration that the convention shall apply only to taxes on income or profits is set out in Clause 3, Mr. Speaker, and the competent authority is there set out to be the Commissioner of Income Tax in Clause 4. Clauses 5 and 6 set out duties and functions and provide latitude for them to be extended by the government in writing by any other enactment. Clauses 7 to 14 set out the basis upon which information may be exchanged, and under Clause 7, the condition that needs to be satisfied is whether the information is foreseeably relevant to the administration or enforcement of any laws, whether in Gibraltar or in the requesting state, relating to taxes on income or profits. Clause 9 allows the government to automatically exchange information when the government agrees with one or more states to such automatic exchange. Clause 10 deals with a spontaneous exchange of information on the basis set out in Article 71A to E, which are replicated in our Act, resolutely verbatim. A deals with the competent authority having grounds for supposing that there may be a loss of tax in another jurisdiction. A person being liable to tax under B obtains a reduction in or an exemption from tax in Gibraltar, which would give rise to an increase in tax or to liability to tax in the other state. Under C, business dealings between a person liable to tax in Gibraltar in another state and a person liable to tax in Gibraltar in another state, as the case may be, are conducted through one or more countries in such a way that a saving in tax may result in Gibraltar and the other state or in both Gibraltar and in that other state. Indeed, because a competent authority has grounds for supposing that a saving of tax may result from artificial transfers of profit within groups of enterprises, or at E, that information forwarded to the competent authority by another state has enabled information to be obtained, which may be relevant in assessing liability tax in the other state. On the advice of the income tax office, clauses 11 to 14 incorporate the powers that exist in the International Corporation Tax Information Act 2009, and which are deemed appropriate for the competent authority to be able to respond to the request that should be made to it. Clause 16 deals with the simultaneous tax examinations which two competent authorities agree to. Clause 17 covers tax examinations abroad and allows the competent authority to make arrangements to allow representatives of another competent authority of the applicant state to be present at the appropriate part of a tax examination in Gibraltar, but always subject to a minister's approval. As provided for in the convention, the competent authority needs to have exclusive competence over the conduct of the tax examination held in Gibraltar. Clause 20 deals with the protection of persons' rights and sets out limitations permitted by the convention. The competent authority, in particular, is not obliged to provide assistance when the request is A, for the competent authority to carry out measures which are at variance with the laws of or administrative practice in Gibraltar, B, seeks that measure to be carried out which are contrary to public policy, E, requires information to be supplied which is not obtainable under the laws of or administrative practice in Gibraltar, D, requires information to be supplied that would disclose any trade, business, industrial, commercial, or professional secret, or trade process, or information the disclosure of which would be contrary to public policy. E is for administrative assistance, and the competent authority considers that the taxation in the applicant's state is contrary to generally accepted taxation principles, or to the provisions of a convention for the avoidance of double taxation, or of any other convention which the government has concluded with the applicant state. F is for the provision of administrative assistance for the purposes of administering or enforcing a provision of the tax law of the applicant state, or any requirement connected therewith, which discriminates against the Gibraltar national as compared with the national of the applicant state in the same circumstances, or G is for administrative assistance and the applicant state does not perceive all reasonable measures available under its laws or administrative practice, except where recourse to such measures would give rise to disproportionate difficulty. The limitation period provided for in the convention is 15 years, and that's set out under Clause 21. Clause 23 deals with confidentiality and how the competent authority may use the information. The confidentiality provisions in Section 3 of the Income Tax Act are relied upon in respect of information obtained under the bill. Clause 25 on costs provides that unless the competent authority has, with the Minister for Finance's prior consent, agreed otherwise, ordinary costs involved or incurred in providing assistance shall be borne by the competent authority, and B, extraordinary costs incurred in providing assistance shall be borne by the applicant state. Clause 26 covers jurisdiction over proceedings relating to measures taken under the convention. Set Clause 1 provides that proceedings related to measures taken under the convention shall be subject to the jurisdiction of the requested state. Sub Clause 2 concerns proceedings relating to measures taken by the requesting state and found jurisdiction in that state, whilst providing for the requesting state to state any action it is taken pursuant to the request pending the final outcome of the requesting state. Clause 26 does not apply to proceedings under clauses 13 and 14, which deal with proceedings to search and seizure and to obtain a production order. Clause 27 provides an element of forwarding or forward proofing by empowering the government to make regulations for the administration or implementation of this bill and complies with any OECD, Council of Europe, European Union, or other international obligations. Clause 28 provides that the government and the competent authorities shall not be liable in damages for anything done or omitted in the discharge of their functions under the bill
unless it is shown that the act or omission was in bad faith. By way of general note, in Clause 16, the simultaneous tax examination clause, Clause 17, the tax examination for fraud clause, and Clause 25, the cost clause, the exercise of the power and discretion by the competent authority is subject to the Minister's prior approval or consent. Reservations and declarations have been entered into, Mr. Speaker, on behalf of Gibraltar by the United Kingdom at our request. Pursuant to Article 30, Paragraph 1A of the Convention, the Government of Gibraltar will not provide any form of assistance in relation to the taxes of other parties described in Article 2, Paragraph 1B of the Convention. Pursuant to Article 30, Paragraph 1D of the Convention, the Government of Gibraltar will not provide assistance in the recovery of any tax claim or in the recovery of an administrative fine for all taxes. Pursuant to Article 30, Paragraph 1C of the Convention, the Government of Gibraltar will not provide assistance in respect of any tax claim which, where a reservation has previously been made under Article 30, Paragraph 1A or B of the Convention, is in existence at the date of withdrawal of such a reservation in relation to the taxes in the category in question. Pursuant to Article 30, Paragraph 1B of the Convention, the Government of Gibraltar will not provide assistance in the service of documents for all taxes listed in Article 2, Paragraph 1 of the Convention. And pursuant to Article 30, Paragraph 1E of the Convention, the Government of Gibraltar will not permit the service of documents through the post. The following is because of declarations that the United Kingdom has entered to Gibraltar. In accordance with Article 2, Paragraph 2, and in respect of Annex A, the Government of the United Kingdom declares that for Gibraltar, the Convention shall apply for those taxes in Article 2, Paragraph 1, which fall under Paragraph A, Little 1. In accordance with Article 3, Paragraph 1b, and in respect of Annex B, the Government of the United Kingdom declares that the competent authority for Gibraltar shall be the Commissioner of Income Tax of the Government of Gibraltar. That's a specific declaration required. And in accordance with Article 3, Paragraph 1e, and in respect of Annex C, the Government of the United Kingdom has declared that in relation to Gibraltar, the term national means a Gibraltarian within the meaning of the Gibraltarian Status Act of 1962, and any legal person, partnership, or association deriving its status as such from the laws in force of Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, in relation to this bill, which was published last week, I have also circulated a letter certifying it to be too urgent to await the 6-week period of publication before it can be proceeded with by this House. As honourable members will recall, I discussed the extension to Gibraltar of the OECD Multilateral Convention with the Right Honourable the Prime Minister, David Cameron, during the course of my visit to Downing Street in June, and had written to him before then to seek the said extension to Gibraltar. The extension of the convention occurred in Jakarta on the 21st of November last year, a meeting of the OECD which was attended by the Government's Minister for Financial Services, Albert Isler. Since then, the process of drafting our national legislation, not an easy piece of legislation to draft at that, has proceeded at a very fast pace. We were able to publish it last week. But the deadline for implementation internationally, Mr. Speaker, is the 1st of March this year. And we want to meet that deadline and not have to explain why we are having to catch up thereafter. For that reason, Mr. Speaker, we have considered it to be in the public interest of Gibraltar to proceed with this bill now as a matter of urgency. And I commend the bill to the House.
If I put a question, does any honourable member wish to speak on general principles and merits of the bill?
Mr. Speaker, yes. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Chief Minister provided me with a copy of the letter, a copy of the letter, providing me with a copy of the letter certifying that the bill was urgent. Having discussed the matter with him, I'm satisfied that it is urgent because this is a measure that needs to be introduced here in Gibraltar before the 1st of March. And that's the urgency, so the opposition has accepted that this is an urgent measure, and therefore we've agreed that the matter be brought to the House without the proper notice. Mr. Speaker, these types of measures are never easy for the finance sector, and there is always going to be a level of scepticism from some operators within the finance sector in relation to measures of this nature, which by their nature are intrusive. The position will be voting in favour of this, and we'll be voting in favour of this really on two grounds. One, that it builds upon existing measures, as I'll explain in a moment. But two, the reality of the situation is that
if it does not already, if these measures does not already apply to, or will apply to, our competitors, sooner or later, our competitors will be subsumed within what is a clear international trend that finance centers like Gibraltar and others, our competitors, will not be able to avoid. Mr. Speaker, about I said that it builds on existing structures. At the moment, what we have is 27 tier agreements, some of which, most of which, I think it's true to say, were negotiated by the GOP government when we were in government, some of them by the Honourable Gentleman opposite during their term in government. And as I say to when I talk in the United Kingdom and also in Spain about this, is 27 tier agreements and the exchange of information, not only with the smaller countries, important as smaller countries are, but with the larger frontline countries like the United States and Germany. On top of that, we also have existing as part of our law a directive which has been implemented that has the effect of creating tiers with members of the European Union, effectively the 27 tiers, are then converted into tiers with all the European Union member states by virtue of the directive. The directive also provides within the European Union for automatic exchange of information and also for spontaneous exchange of information. Now, this latter measure, this convention, which is an OECD initiative, what it seeks to do is to extend effectively the scope of the directive in terms of clear, spontaneous exchange and automatic exchange to countries that are not members of, may not be members of the European Union, but are also signed up to this particular convention. And I'm told in the conversation that I had with Mr. Tupin yesterday from the Finance Centre that the effect of it would be to create effectively 70 tier agreements. In other words, that it would have the effect of Gibraltar having agreements with 70 countries, members of the OECD, including, it has to be said, although that was covered by the directive, the Kingdom of Spain. So the effect of all these measures that I've described is to create a clear agreement for exchange of information between Gibraltar and the Kingdom of Spain, which has hitherto resisted the idea of having a bilateral agreement with Gibraltar. Now, Mr. Speaker, therefore, for all those reasons, the opposition will be supporting the bill and we will be voting in favour of it.
Mr. Speaker, I'm pleased to see that the opposition will be supporting this bill. And I've heard the Honourable Gentleman say in the course of the reasoning why they will be supporting this bill, much of what I said myself in the introduction of the bill. But I just want to take issue with a few minor points that you mentioned. The Honourable Gentleman mentioned to not having given the proper notice. Well, can I just caveat that by saying that by sending a letter specifying the Bill of Regents, it doesn't mean that there is improper notice in any way. There is full compliance with the provisions of the Constitution and of the requirements for a bill to pass this House. I don't for one moment think that he was suggesting that there was improper notice, but the use of the word proper, I think, could have led others to think that. So this is an entirely proper procedure that is being pursued. The Honourable Gentleman said that some members of the Finance Centre may find these issues are not easy to deal with. Well, Mr. Speaker, financial services business has changed and is changing. I remember the prophets of doom long before I was a member of this House suggested that in 1995, when the GSLP was legislating to deal with the issues of anti-money laundering on an all-crime basis, there were some who feared that not because we were involved in money laundering, but because our clients, as it were, system, might not want to jump to hoops. That might be the end of the finance center, and we've grown from strength to strength since then. But Speaker, this government has a very clear approach to everything that relates to Gibraltar's international relationship, whether it's our relationship with the European Union or our compliance with international conventions, and that is a culture of compliance. That's why one of the first things that I understood we did and we invested in when I was elected was that we came completely up to date with all outstanding directive measures that we were required to take both under European law. And there were many, Mr. Speaker, that were outstanding. Mr. Speaker, one of those was the multilateral directive that had the equivalent effect to this convention at the European level between the member states. The Honourable Member has tangentially referred to that by saying that now we have the equivalent of a tier with Spain, even though they won't enter into a bilateral tier with us. Well, Mr. Speaker, we have that not as a result of this convention, I think it's important to set out explicitly that that is the case, not as a result of this convention, but as a result of the directive that we instilled was transposed into law. Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister David Cameron, when he was the president of the G8, grasped the nettle and decided that it was important to ensure that the unfair criticism that had been levied against many of the overseas territories and the crown dependencies of the United Kingdom should be dealt with. He addressed the issue that others had failed to address before him. And Gibraltar was pleased to be with him, Mr. Speaker, in leading in the compliance by overseas territories and crown dependencies on all matters relating to international conventions to ensure that money laundering and tax evasion became a thing of the past. The Prime Minister himself, after all the overseas territories and crown dependencies together at the same time, agreed to the extension of this convention, has said in Parliament that it would be wrong and unfair for anybody to describe any of the overseas territories and crown dependencies, and that of course includes Gibraltar, as tax havens after this multilateral convention of the OECD has been extended to us, and in particular in the case of Gibraltar, that already have equivalent to this OECD convention with all of the member states of the European Union, the largest economies in the world, and the United States of America. Mr. Speaker, I have absolutely no doubt that the financial services world is very different today to what it might have been 20 years ago and will be very different in 20 years' time. It's a brave new world, but not for that reason a world to fear.
I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to implement the Convention on Mutual Administrative Assistance in Tax Matters of the 21st of January 1988, as amended by the Protocol amending the Convention on Mutual Administrative Assistance in Tax Matters of the 27th of May 2010, and for collective purposes, be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Taxation Mutual Administrative Assistance Act 2014.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to give notice that the committee stays on third reading of the bill be taken today with all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stays on third reading of the bill be taken today?
A bill for an act to provide for the preservation and protection of seas and for collective purposes. The Honourable the Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill to provide for the preservation and protection of trees and for connected purposes be read a first time.
I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to provide for the preservation and protection of trees and for connected purposes be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Protection of Trees Act 2013.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill now be read a second time. Mr. Speaker, before I commence, I have given notice by letter, which we can take obviously at the committee stage, of a change in the title of the bill to the Environmental Protection Bracket Tree, Close Bracket 2014. And this bill was initially published as a command paper towards the end of last year, and makes provision for the protection and preservation of trees in Gibraltar. Trees, Mr. Speaker, are important in the urban landscape, as they provide shelter for wildlife, They provide oxygen, remove harmful particulate matter, and are excessively pleasing. Indeed, there is evidence to suggest that the health of communities in areas with trees is significantly better than in urban areas without. The loss of trees in Gibraltar has been a cause for concern in the past. There are a number of reasons why people request that trees are removed, and these may be for danger, structural reasons, desirability for construction, with the trees being in the way, health, and inconvenience. There is currently an existing regime under Section 38 of the Town Planning Act 1999, which allows the Development and Planning Commission to make a tree preservation order. If the tree is subject to such an order, the cutting down, chopping, locking, or willful destruction of the tree is prohibited without the consent of the commission. There are currently 47 tree preservation orders in Gibraltar. This bill repeals Section 38 of the Town Planning Act, as it replaces that regime, but also expands it in order to improve upon the powers of the commission. Furthermore, this bill goes beyond the existing regime in that it will apply to all trees, as it introduces a new regime for those trees not subject to tree preservation order. I now turn to the different parts of the bill. Part 1 of the bill applies the Act to the Crown. This is because the most important trees in Gibraltar are often found on government property. In the interest of security, Clause 3.3 allows the government to issue a certificate so that the right of entry found in Clause 19 shall not be excusable in relation to the premises specified in the certificate. Part 2 of the bill deals with tree preservation orders. While all trees provide some benefit to the community, tree preservation orders are used to protect selected trees which are particularly valuable because of their intrinsic beauty, their contribution to the landscape, their scarcity, or their importance as a wildlife habitat, among other reasons. The main purpose of a tree preservation order is to prohibit the pruning, cutting down, uprooting, chopping, locking, willful damage, or willful destruction of a tree as set out in Clause 8 of the bill without the consent of the Development and Planning Committee. Once a commission makes a TPO, it must serve a copy of it on the owner and occupier of the land affected by the order. This is defined in Clause 2 as the land on which the tree is situated. A copy of the order shall be available for public inspection and may also be made available electronically. By virtue of Clause 8 or 6, the commission has the power to vary or revert the TPO as it considers necessary. It must then notify the owner and occupier of the said land. Clause 7 is intended to prevent an owner from intentionally allowing a tree that is subject to a tree preservation order to die or become infected. It allows the commission to issue a notice on the owner of the land to take such steps as may be specified in the notice to prevent, cure, or control infestation or disease, or remedy the condition of the tree. Clause 9 sets out how an application to carry out works for a tree that is subject to a TPO is made to the commission. The commission may, upon receipt of an application, either grant consent unconditionally or, subject to conditions, refuse consent. Or refuse consent. The conditions subject to which consent may be granted include specifying the standard to which work may be carried out and requiring the applicant to plant one or more trees. Consent granted under Clause 10 is valid for a period of 2 years, unless the commission decides to grant consent for a lesser period as a condition for granted consent. Part 3 applies for other trees not subject to the regime under Part 2. A tree that is not subject to a tree preservation order is still caught by the provisions of the bill, but is subject to a much, much less stringent regime. The main aim of this part is to prohibit the cutting down or uprooting of a tree without the consent of a commission, as provided in Clause 13 of the bill. However, in order to prevent any delay caused by the commission in dealing with an application, where an applicant has not received notice of the commission's decision or a reply to the effect that this application has been considered within 28 days, the prohibition shall not apply. Again, the commission may either grant consent unconditionally or subject to conditions or refuse consent. The conditions subject to which consent may be granted include the planting of one or more trees, and unity duration of the consent. Generally, consent will be valid for 1 year. Part 4 deals with the exceptions to the general prohibitions, appeals, etc. Clause 16 sets out the circumstances in which the prohibitions contained in clauses 8 and 13 do not apply. In particular, the prohibition does not apply where the diameter of the tree does not exceed 75 millimeters, where the tree is dead, where work is urgently necessary to remove an immediate risk of serious harm, the removal of dead branches from the tree, or if the tree is removed in compliance with the provisions of the various acts listed in that section. Furthermore, by virtue of clause 16.1g, the prohibitions do not apply to work carried out at the Alameda Gardens or the Nature Reserve, where those works are carried out in accordance with the written authorization of the government in order to allow legitimate management operations. In order to strengthen the powers of the Commission under the Act in relation to its ability to prevent the cutting down of trees in contravention of the Act, Clause 17 allows the Commission to serve a notice on the owner of the land to plant one or more trees of an appropriate size and species. This could be in the same place as the tree that was cut down or uprooted, or in such other area or land as may be agreed between the Commission and the owner of the land. Clause 18 deals with appeals which may be made to the Development Appeals Tribunal appointed under the Town Planning. In particular, an applicant for consent made under clauses 9 or 14 may appeal against the Commission's decision, and the Tribunal has the power to confirm or vary the decision of the Commission, including amending the conditions subject to which consent has been granted. An appeal may also be made by an applicant for consent where he or she has not received notice of the Commission's decision by the end of a period of 8 weeks, beginning with the day the application was received by the Commission. In line with the government's commitment to e-government, Clause 20 allows the applicant to apply to the Commission for consent by way of electronic communication and includes an appeal made to the tribunal as long as it is in a form approved by the Commission. Certain conditions apply. Clause 21 gives the Minister the power to make regulations for carrying out the purpose of the Act. I now commend this bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? Honourable Mr. Nata.
Mr. Speaker, the opposition will be voting in favour of this bill after seeing at the natural progression from the policy introduced by the Jewish government in the Development Commission in order to preserve trees and woodlands during after years in government. There was a bit of movement coming from the government side. After the expansion of Memorandum states, the bill replaces Section 58 of the Town Planning Act 1999. Therefore, any further changes that enhances the preservation of trees and the management thereof in its application is something the petition welcomes. Having said this, the petition does not see why it is necessary to increase in Section 23, which refers to the government's constitutional responsibilities. We would therefore ask the Minister in advance of his reply to our contribution if he could clarify why this clause is not necessary to be included in the bill. Thank you.
Mr. Speaker, thank you very much. Just in relation to this last point that the Honourable Mr. Noto has made, this is a clause that was not uncommon in legislation that potentially impacted on the constitutional responsibilities of the government. So, for example, it was included, I recall, in the Criminal Procedure Act because it might have had an impact in terms of the governor's responsibility for internal security. But we're dealing with preservation of trees. Clause 23, I beg your pardon, the Minister for Justice is asking this clause, is Clause 23. And we just don't understand why Clause 23 has been included when we're talking about tree preservation. What possible explanation could it be? What possible impact could this legislation have on the government's constitutional responsibilities in relation to defense and internal security and other matters? I let the court. I mean,
nobody's going to chop down trees at the convent without the consent of the governor, but even that would not justify the inclusion of this particular clause. We feel that if there is no justification for it, really, I think it's constitutionally bad form to introduce a clause of this nature in legislation that can't possibly impact on the government's constitutional responsibility.
Mr. Speaker, on the last point, I think it is a matter that we can consider as committee space, and we can discuss there. I welcome the opposition's support of this bill. And clearly, I have to make one comment in relation to the honourable member opposite. That it is a progression of the policy of the former administration. It will not be generally known because the Italian Commission met in secret, and that the author of the policy that we are now progressing was, in fact, the person who is now Minister for the Environment.
I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to provide for the preservation and protection of trees and for connected purposes be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Protection of Trees Act 2013.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to give notice that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today with all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stage and first reading of the bill be taken today?
A bill for an act to amend the Animals and Birds Act. The Honourable Minister for Health and Environment.
Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Animals and Birds Act be read for the first time.
Now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Animals and Birds Act purposes be read a third time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Animals and Birds Barbary Macaque Amendment Act 2013.
Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill will be now read a second time. Speaker, before I turn to the substance of the bill, I do want to point out that you and honourable members will be aware I will be moving several amendments at the bill at committee stage. To speak on the substance of the bill, the government is very conscious of the need to ensure that the unauthorised feeding of barbary macaques is properly deterred and that it is adequately punished when it is not deterred. Deterrence in turn depends on the law being and being seen to be enforced. That is why, Mr. Speaker, the government is introducing a number of reforms through the present bill. The first of these reforms is to rehouse Section 547 of the Commons Act 2011, which deals with the offences of enticing and feeding barbary macaques in what will become Section 6A of the Animals and Birds Act. This places the offences in the more appropriate context of animal protection legislation. We have at the same time, and this leads me to the second reform, created a distinction in Section 6A between an offence committed inside the nation reserve and one committed outside it. The practical effect of this is to assign different fixed penalties to these offences, and I will explain these further in a moment. The third reform is the very creation of the fixed penalty notice regime just mentioned. This is contained in Section 6B and will enable authorised officers to issue fixed penalties to offenders on the spot. We see this as a key component of enforcing the law. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, I will immediately be publishing subordinate legislation in the form of rules in order to administer the fixed penalty regime if Parliament approves this bill. It will see that the penalty for offences relating to enticing macaques away from or feeding them outside the nature reserve, contained in Section 6.1a and 612 respectively, following the changes that I will bring up at committee 7, is £500, while the penalty for feeding an account or encouraging another person to do so inside the reserve is £250. This distinction reflects the particular seriousness which the government gives to the presence of matter outside the reserve. I should emphasize that the summary conviction offence with a fine at level 4 on the standard scale, currently £4,000, is carried over from section 547 of the Crimes Act and is thereby retained. The fourth reform is the new definition of authorized officer in the Animals and Birds Act to include wildlife wardens. The inclusion of wildlife wardens will help ensure that these individuals, who are among those most likely to fear an offence being committed, are able to tackle it immediately by issuing a fixed penalty notice. Mr. Speaker, this bill addresses one aspect of controlling the Barbary macaque population, the enforcement of laws prohibiting feeding. It is part, however, of the government's commitment to tackling the challenges and opportunities presented by the Barbary macaque population in a holistic and integrated way. And I commend this bill to the House.
Before I put the question, is any honourable member to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? The honourable Mr. James Nutter.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We in the opposition will be voting in favour of the bill, given the general principle contained therein. We believe that there should be such penalty offences to ensure compliance with the underlying view that illegal feeding of the Barbary macaque is something that this society takes a serious view, and the deterrent for such acts will cause such individuals dearly in their pocket. The opposition does, however, have some misgivings. The fact is that there has never been any prosecution, and this legislation on its own will not deal with the problem. We still continue to ask the Minister as to where are the nature reserve wardens that he used to say when in Gong that would solve this particular problem. As I said, we are particularly voting in favour of the bill, but we will be monitoring the implementation of the new legislation very closely. No doubt the Minister will continue to blame the GSP government for everything which is wrong, despite the fact that the Minister has been dealing with the treatment of macaques for the last 30 years. But upon enacting this bill, if the outcome becomes as sterile as the 2 years in which the Honourable Member has been the Minister for Environment, then he will find himself at the end of a long branch with nowhere to go but pressing down to a hard surface of public opinion with nobody willing to pick him up. Our advice to the Minister is that we've had enough of theory and excuses. What the public wants at last is real, tangible practice on the ground.
Yes, Speaker, just a small point. Mr. Speaker, there are no substantive offences, no new substantive offences created by this bill. I mean, effectively, what this bill does is takes out of the Crimes Bill the substantive offences created in the Crimes Act and puts it in this new piece of legislation for the policy reasons the government has outlined, which is that it believes that these types of offences ought to be dealt with in animal protection legislation. I have to say that I don't agree with that, and I hope that in future the government perhaps think carefully about taking things out of the Crimes Act, which was intended to be a codified piece of legislation dealing with all our criminal offences, though for those few, so the criminal practitioners had effectively a Bible, so to speak, to consult when faced with cases which they deal with on behalf of clients. We're voting in favour of it because we believe that even though it creates more substantive offences, some of the other amendments are worthwhile. They could have been introduced into the Crimes Act, but I urge the government to rethink any policy in the future, taking out of the Crimes Act, and then dealing with it piecemeal in other pieces of legislation that just complicates things for practitioners.
What to do with the offence the Honourable Member has made? We certainly don't agree that
where you've got legislation other than the Crimes Act, where an offence is created or exists, that is dealing with criminal legislation on a piecemeal basis. We had this morning the Tobacco Act Amendment, which creates an offence, not in a Crimes Act, in the Tobacco Act, of concealment in a vehicle, which the Honourable Member has supported for the reasons that he has stated. It hasn't taken out our offence, but it isn't true to say that the Crimes Act is simply a co-defined piece of legislation of all offences in Gibraltar. That is it. Yes, I do.
And I haven't said that. No, I haven't said that. I didn't say that. I actually said there are other criminal offences in other pieces of legislation. The point I'm making is that I'm urging upon the government a policy not to take out of the Crimes Act to deal with in separate pieces of legislation, because we have a wonderful piece of legislation which we drafted, they implemented, dealing with 90% of our criminal offences. And I don't think it's the right policy. That's all I know. It's up to them to be taken out of the Crimes Act to introduce it into separate legislation, which I've described as a piecemeal. Perhaps that's not the best way to describe it, but the Honourable Gentleman gets the gist of what I'm saying. Mr. Speaker, this isn't so much an issue of policy, but what is appropriate and what is convenient in any particular case. We have a Crimes Act, which isn't a co-defined piece of legislation of all criminal offences in Gibraltar, but it is a repetition of what was included in the Criminal Offences Act originally, plus an extension with new offences being created, particularly offences involving children, sexual offences, and all that. Where we have focused it appropriate to add legislation to the Crimes Act, we have done that, and I gave that example this morning in relation to the question of harassment, and I won't repeat what I said earlier, but the position before is that we had a commitment to introduce a protection of harassment act, and instead of creating that separate piece of legislation, we simply incorporated the provisions that we wanted to include in the existing provisions, or further to the existing provisions in the Crimes Act, and that shows that there is flexibility of the approach. Where we feel it is appropriate to add offences to the Crimes Act, where we do so. Where we feel that it is appropriate to add offences to other pieces of legislation, like we did this morning with the Tobacco Act, because we don't have all the tobacco offences in the Crimes Act, we have a separate piece of legislation dealing with that, and we have, in fact, a separate piece of legislation dealing with protection of animals and birds, and this is part of that piece of legislation. And therefore, it is a matter that we take some thought to, whether we should make these amendments to the existing provisions in the Crimes Act, or we should repeal those provisions and have them in the Animals and Birds Act. We took the latter view. The Honourable Member may have taken a different view, but I don't think it's just a substantial issue of policy. It's almost as if the Honourable Member wants to protect his baby, and anything we do to interfere with that baby to say something like is wrong. Well, I don't think that is the right approach to legislation. Does the Honourable Member wish to reply?
Speaker, I would like to thank my learned colleague, the Honourable Learned Colleague, the Minister for Justice, not the former Minister for Justice, not in the way former, of course, for assisting in this discussion. I do have to correct the former and the Honourable Minister for Justice in suggesting that there is nothing new in this piece of legislation. The aspect of enticing is a new concept. Also, the difference in that there will be higher fines outside the nature reserve than inside the nature reserve to stress the fact that it is possibly something that has to be taken more seriously. And the issue of tickets rather than the other more long out process of the magistrate's court, which is still an option for going forth. It is now no longer just the police, but also, Mr. Speaker, all the technical and enforcement members of the Department of Environment, including the new Environmental Protection Officers, and the officers of the Environmental Agency. So it is increasing the number of people who will be able to enforce this new law. Over and beyond the wildlife wardens, which the member of the group has continuously tried to provoke me by saying that I said all these wonderful things are happening, or were going to be happening when we had wildlife wardens. In fact, there would be more people now on the ground than any wildlife wardens I would have dreamt about at the time enforcing this piece of legislation. Mr. Speaker, there are some people who even today tell me that I'm too nice and too good to be a politician. I think that the honourable member of this House has almost convinced me that I think because as he started welcoming this piece of legislation and saying, you know, how he was supported and so on, I said, well, isn't this great? Let's just stick to the business and I'm not going to then stand up and tell him all the things he didn't do when he was Minister for the Environment. And there he goes and begins a personal attack on me, even wishing me to fall from the branch of a tree. No doubt a tree of one of the hundreds that I have already planted in these 2 years when I've been there. It begs me to ask all of the honourable member of this, how can you forget? Have you forgotten the conversations that we had when you were my minister and I, your lawyer contractor? Have you forgotten the correspondence that I and other professionals wrote to you when we warned you that if you did not listen to what we were wanting to tell you, that the problem that we are having now with the body of the we are going to have it in a few years? All I can tell you, thank God, that I am now the minister and not particularly what I'm going to tell you. But let me come back on the tree again, for which I have no intention of falling. Mr. Speaker, the allusion to the lack of prosecution, always trying to put the blame on me for such lack of prosecution, when he party was in government for 16 years when they didn't prosecute anybody. It's almost unbelievable when nobody was prosecuted, not for the government to prosecute. It's almost unbelievable. And it's precisely because perhaps the law was too cumbersome that we have introduced this new regime which may be able to tackle offenders in a more practical and realistic manner. Mr. Speaker, I'm not going to refer again to the correspondence. I have published some of the letters in the past to show exactly what the former government was not doing and how it was not listening. We are doing a lot of other things. We've increased the human resources now tackling the matter considerably. We have introduced this bill, we have carried out habitat improvement and a lot of other measures that we will be hearing of very soon. But needless to say, I will once again at the next opportunity be accused of not no, I don't think I will do that. I will once again be accused of not doing anything when in 2 sterile years, despite the fact that there were 16 sterile years and all range of things that we all recall because we don't have that sort of memory. Mr. Speaker, I will leave it at that. I'm glad that the opposition will support this, but I am disappointed because I did think that at last we were going to see the opposition standing shoulder to shoulder with the government, tackling and supporting a problem which we have to resolve and that we have both got a role in getting all of our supporters to support the work that we are trying to do in order to properly manage the badly mapped population.
Yeah.
now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Animals and Birds Act be read a second time. Are we in favor? Vote against. Carried.
The Animals and Birds Barbarian Attack Amendment Act 2013.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to give notice that the committee stage on third reading of the bill be taken today if all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stage on third reading of the bill be taken today?
A bill for an act to amend the Civilians Act, which include a reference or reference to the Minister with responsibility for trade and industry. The Honourable Minister for Education, Telecommunications and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Miscellaneous Act, which include a reference or references to the Minister with responsibility for trade and industry, be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Miscellaneous Act, which includes a reference or references to the Minister with responsibility for trade and industry, be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Trade and Industry Miscellaneous Amendments Act 2013.
Speaker, I beg to move that the bill be now read a second time. The bill reflects changes in ministerial portfolios and responsibilities that took place back in December 2011 when that wireless endowment occurred, as a result of which there is no longer a post which can be easily identified as being either the Minister for Trade and Industry or the Minister with responsibility for both trade and industry. And therefore, there has been a need to identify the people of legislation that referred to the Minister in those terms and to correct them. But this bill does not create any new powers at all. It simply amends the title of the Minister. And instead of the current legislation, Mr. Speaker, has identified 8 acts which would benefit from amendments. So as to clarify which particular Minister will undertake the duties and responsibilities under those particular acts. And the amendments have been drafted so that the description of the Minister is no longer tied to multiple responsibilities. There is a description of the Minister now, or the wisdom, or for one responsibility. So whoever may have that responsibility in the future will be the Minister responsible under these particular acts without the need for further amendment if there is any kind of changes as there was in December 2011. Mr. Speaker, the acts amended by the bill and the relevant minister for the act are firstly the Intellectual Property Copyright and Related Rights Act 2005, and that is changed to the Minister with Responsibility for Commercial Affairs. The Motor Fuel Consumption and Content Act 2011 to the Minister with Responsibility for the Environment. The European Public Limited Liability Company Act 2005, to the Minister with Responsibility for Financial Services, the Petroleum Act, to the Minister with Responsibility for the Environment, the Business Trade and Professions Registration Act, to the Minister with Responsibility for Employment, the Export Control Act 2005, to the Minister with Responsibility for Finance, the Deep Sea Mining Licensing Act, to the Minister with Responsibility for the Environment, and the Disclosure of the Interest in Shares Act to the Minister with Responsibility for Financial Services. The CPAC member votes with that.
Any other member who could speak on the general principles of merit for the bill? I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act on any miscellaneous act, which include a reference, all references, to the Minister with Responsibility for Trade and Industry be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against?
The Trade and Industry Miscellaneous Amendments Act 2013.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to give notice of the committee stage on third reading of the bill to be taken today. Do all honourable members agree?
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stage on third reading of the bill be taken today?
Committee stage on third reading. The Honourable Chief Minister.
Speaker, I have the honour to move that the House should resolve itself into committee to consider the following bills called by clause. The Standing Amendment Bill 2013, the Employment, Bullying at Work Bill 2013, the Tobacco Amendment Bill 2014, the Taxation Mutual Administrative Assistance Bill 2014, the Protection of Trees Bill 2013, the Animals and Birds Tribunal Act Amendment Bill 2013, and the Trade and Industry Miscellaneous Amendment Bill 2013.
A bill for an act to amend the Stamp Duty Act 2005. Clauses 1 and 2.
Stand part of the bill.
The long title.
Stand part of the bill.
A bill for an act to prohibit bullying and victimization in employment and for connected purposes.
In respect of this bill, a letter has been circulated to honourable members with what I describe as a very minor typographical amendment, which honourable members will be able to see. I think it's been circulated now. They are literally minor typographical amendments. One of them is the typographical amendment that the honourable gentleman spotted, as well as the absence of a little C, which we'll come to, but they are not in any instance a substantive change, they're all typographic.
May I suggest that rather than go through,
because they are purely typographical amendments, and the Chief Minister has given clear notice of them, I think that the committee will agree that they're all being incorporated into the bill.
Mr. Chairman, there is one further typographical amendment in clause which is not included in the letter, and that's in clause 2, where it defines minister as minister with responsibility for employment. The E in employment should be a small E rather than a capital E. That is just to make it consistent with the way we are drafting legislation and defining minister with responsibilities.
I hope that can also be incorporated, and that when the Act is published, it will appear and it has to be monitored.
Clauses 1 to 11 and the schedule.
Clauses 1 to 11 and the schedule stand part of the bill.
The long title.
The long title stand part of the bill.
A bill for an act to amend the Tobacco Act 1997. Clauses 1 and 2 and the long title.
Clauses 1 and 2 and the long title stand part of the bill.
A bill for an act to implement the Convention on Mutual Administrative Assistance in tax matters of the 21st of January 1988, as amended by the Protocol, amended the Convention on Mutual Administrative Assistance in tax matters of the 27th of May 2010, and for connected purposes. Clauses 1 to 29, the schedule and the long title.
Clauses 1 to 29, the schedule and the long title stand part of the bill.
A bill for an act provided for the preservation and protection of trees and for connected purposes. Clause 1.
Clause 1.
Chairman,
the Honourable Mr. Protest.
As I have circulated, the intention of the Chairman is that for the Wildlife Protection of Trees Act 2013,
which is practically the word Environmental Protection Bracket 2, closed bracket, Act 2014.
Well, Honourable Members, I agree that the amendment moved by the Honourable Mr. Cortez should be included in the bill. Clauses 2 to 22.
If I may deal with the point here, sir, Mr. Chairman, if I may deal with the point that Mr. Nessel made in which the legal position followed up in respect of the reference after paragraph 23, which is outside the scope of the clauses called by the class at the moment of the government's constitutional responsibility. The reason I want to deal with it now is because the reason for it is actually in section 3. Section 3 of this bill applies the act to the government. And section 3.3 sets out that the government may specify that in the interest of the security of Gibraltar, the right of entry under section 19 shall not be exercisable in relation to the premises specified in the certificate. That is taking to the government of Gibraltar rather than putting in the governor the right to specify something in the interest of Gibraltar. And when we do things like that, we specifically provide that that is not a derogation from the constitutional power in respect to the security of Gibraltar that the governor has specifically set out in the constitution. That is therefore the reason why section 23 is there. I entirely agree with the reasoning that it should not be there unless it needs to be there. That is the reason why it needs to be there.
Clauses 2 to 25, the schedule on the long title.
Clauses 2 to 25, the schedule on the long title, and part of the bill.
The bill for an act to amend the Animals and Birds Act. Clause 1.
And part of the bill?
Clause 2.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, as I alluded to in my speech earlier, a number of amendments have been submitted by copies of the letter to you. The first one is a typographical error in 6b3. The definition should be of conviction, not of conviction.
Again, we have a similar situation. They are merely typographical errors. They are not substantive amendments. The Honourable Member has given notice. It's been circulated. And therefore, the committee agrees that these should all be incorporated into the Act.
And therefore, to go to the committee. Yeah.
Clauses 1 and 2 and the long title. Clauses 1 and 2 and the long title.
1 and 2. Clauses 1 and 2 and the long title stand part of the bill.
A bill for an act to amend the Miscellaneous Act, which include a reference or references to the Minister with responsibility for trade and industry. Clauses 1 to 9 and the long title.
Clauses 1 to 9 and the long title stand part of the bill.
The Honourable Mr. Chairman.
Speaker, I have the honour to report that the Stamp Duties Amendment Bill 2013, the Employment Work Bill 2013, the Tobacco Amendment Bill 2014, the Taxation Mutual Administrative Assistance Bill 2014, the Protection of Bees of Trees Bill 2013, now renamed, the Animals and Birds Guardian Attacks Amendment Bill 2013, and the Trade and Industry Miscellaneous Amendments Bill 2013 have been considered in committee and agreed to with amendments, and I now move that they be read a third time and passed.
I now put a question, which is that 1. The Stamp Duties Amendment Bill 2013, 2. The Employment Bullying at Work Bill 2013, 3. The Tobacco Amendment Bill 2014, 4. The Taxation Neutral Administrative Assistance Bill 2014, 5. The Protection of Trees Bill 2013 with the amended title, 6. The Animals and Birds Farthing Macaques Amendment Bill 2013, 7. The Trade and Industry Miscellaneous Amendments Bill 2013 be read a third time and passed. Those in favour of the Stamp Duties Amendment Bill 2013? Those against? Carried. Those in favour of the Employment Bullying at Work Bill 2013? Mr. Speaker, can I call for a division on this bill, please?
The Honourable P.J. Balbine. The Honourable J.J. Bafana is absent. The Honourable D.J. Bafina.
Abstaining.
The Honourable P.I. Caruana is absent. The Honourable Dr. J. E. Coquet. The Honourable M. S. Costa. The Honourable Mrs. Fanny Mandel Honey.
Abstain.
The Honourable D. A. Beaton.
Abstain.
The Honourable S. M. T. Ellis is absent. The Honourable Dr. David Garcia.
Yes.
The Honourable A.J. Eastler. The Honourable G.H. McCoody.
Aye.
The Honourable S.E. Linaro.
Aye.
The Honourable J.J. Mako.
Abstain.
The Honourable F. R. Picardo.
Aye.
The Honourable E. J. Hall.
And his name, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable F. J. Kavanagh.
There are 3 members absent. 5 members have abstained. There are 9 members in favour. The ayes have it. Carried. The employment the tobacco. Right. Yes. Those in favour of the Tobacco Amendment Bill 2014, those against, carried. Those in favour of the Taxation Neutral Administrative Assistance Bill 2014, those against, carried. Those in favour of the Protection of Trees Bill 2014, those against, carried. Those in favour of the Animals and Birds Barbary Macaques Amendment Bill 2013, those against, carried. And those in favour of the Trade and Industry Miscellaneous Amendments Bill 2013, those against, carried.
Mr. Speaker, I rise to move that the House to now adjourn to the year, but before I do, it is not lost on us on this side of the House that this may be the last moment that we have Mr. Melvin Farrell, the clerk of the House, with us discharging his function, which he has already done now for some years as clerk of the House before he retired. Mr. Speaker, Mr. Farrell has loyally served to this House, and he has loyally served Gibraltar as a civil servant before he arrived in this House as such. From the time that I have been conscious of his work, he has served two ministers at No. 6 of Convent Grace. He has served in the Registry, and he has, of course, served with distinction in this House. I have always found, as I know my colleagues on this side of the House, and no doubt on the other side of the House, that Mr. Farrell is impeccably polite, impartial, and unflappable in any situation. And he has found himself, no doubt, in all the years that he has been a civil servant in many situations. Mr. Speaker, those who of us who have the benefit of having a crib have always found our crib impeccable as a result of his diligent work. He has always been a friend to everyone in this House and an enemy of none of us. He's also a distinguished member of HMS Calpe, retired distinguished member of HMS Calpe, and of course he has been discharging his function not just as clerk of this House in this House, but he has been the organiser of European elections and the organiser of national elections. And I will always remember him, Mr. Speaker, reading out the names of those who were duly elected to this Parliament after the last general election. I have him standing on the stage at Manchester Hall, ingrained in my mind as he read those names. Mr. Speaker, I am sure that this is not the end of Melvin Farrell's distinguished service to Gibraltar, and I am sure that it must be recognised beyond the words I am uttering today. And we were reminded by the previous speaker, who is not here today, no doubt not out of any desire not to be here to share with us celebrating Melvin's work, that he is, of course, the last civil servant to hold what, and therefore his retirement today will enable his diligent approach and savings to start accruing for the benefit of not just him but also his family, although we sincerely hope, and we go through the wish, I no doubt of everyone in this House, that the what criteria should not kick in for many years to come. Mr. Speaker, certainly on this side of the House, we associate ourselves entirely with everything that the Honourable Chief Minister and the Leader of the House have said about Melvin. But yesterday, when I was talking to my opposition colleagues, well, what can I say about Melvin? And almost to the man and almost to the woman, the one word that resonated in description of Melvin was the word loyal. Melvin has not only been loyal as senior officer of Her Majesty's Scouter with a reserve decoration, loyal to Her Majesty's Scouter, loyal to the civil service in his 47 and a half years of service to the public service here in Gibraltar, loyal to the Parliament
with which he has served since 2006, and loyal, of course, above all, to Gibraltar and to this community. Melvin is diligent, he is meticulous, and he has an eye for detail. I have to say that when I first became a member of the opposition, it's less likely when we are ministers and I submitted my question, I would have Melvin on the phone to me and say, well, don't you think that perhaps you can frame this question in this particular way? I said, well, Melvin, do you suggest a change of question to everybody? And he said, there's not one person who I have served as a class that I have not suggested a change of question. And I have to say, always to improve the question. And therefore, I have absolutely no hesitation in associating myself with the Honourable the Chief Minister, and to wish Melvin and his family all the best for the future. And that if in future Melvin's service to this community during his long years of service is to be recognised in any way, I can assure this House that the opposition will be entirely, entirely supportive of it, because I can think of no one else that is as worthy of the commission as Melvin Fowler.
May I associate myself with those very kind remarks about the talk about Melvin Fowler. Let me put his service into perspective. He has served a total of 47 years. And that means that he could have retired with full service at least 10 years ago. And he has carried on for about another 10 years, well beyond the age of 60. In fact, I'm not going to reveal his age, but it is well beyond the age of 60. When I took over the task of chairing the proceedings of Parliament in October 2012, I knew Melvin beforehand, and I knew and was confident of the extent to which I was going to rely on his guidance and his advice and his help would exceed all my expectations. And this I can vouch for. He has been a top of confidence. He has the accumulated wisdom of many years here in Parliament, which I have been able to draw upon in order to help me in what is not an easy task. He's been loyal, he's been a great counselor, and above all, a great friend. And even though he will no longer sit in that chair, our friendship will endure forever. So I associate myself with a member. I wish him many years of retirement, and which will be able to enjoy with his gracious lady. But behind every great man, there is a great woman. And this is a job which entails on occasions great sacrifice. Sometimes the members here, the staff of Parliament, are working here till the early hours of the morning, and people, the public, may not realize that. And there is a lady at home waiting for the clerk and the others to return. It's not very, because it would be the end of seeing Melvin here, but a very fulfilling day, and a day which I think points and indicates that in Gibraltar we are blessed with a very great civil service. They are great upholders of the task, and they serve the needs of our nation, of our country, very, very, to their highest standard in any other parliament. May God bless you.
I'm sorry I'm being rather emotional, but that's the way I am, and I'm grateful to all of you for your kind words and
So I move, Mr. Speaker, that we now adjourn to the VA and let him go.
I will now adjourn to the VA.